Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Investment Director Catherine Young weighs in on opportunities across equity markets in Asia against the backdrop of U.S. elections, COVID-19, and uncertainty in global trade. She focuses on value investing in China and whether there is room to grow on this in the future. She comments on the Chinese economy and consumer behavior. Before the pandemic, China was a very cash-driven society. Nobody ever really used credit cards. Now Chinese consumers have moved straight to digital payments. She explains how the Chinese economy is driven by consumption and services. Since March, they've had around 7 V-shaped recoveries, and it's all playing out from a domestic market perspective. Making sure there's no disruption to China's supply chain is important, as China makes up 40% of global growth, which is more than Japan and US combined. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on October 23rd, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada, ULC, or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
So, Catherine, I'll begin, if you don't mind, with sort of asking this broad question about how, in the last several months of volatility, real excitement in some of the equity markets, China has almost become a safe asset. How did we get to this perception on some level? What's gone into that?
Of contributing factors, Pamela. So the first one is before COVID even, when we look at the Chinese mainland stock market, so the A-share market, it had a very, very low correlation with US equity. So perhaps one of the lowest correlations in the world. So in that regard, I guess because now we're seeing China doing very well from a normalization perspective, it's viewed in a safe haven asset class for minds or perception-wise. Secondly, don't forget, we're also seeing the rise of the Chinese consumer as well as the rise of the Chinese household wealth and therefore the rise of the Chinese investor base. And so this has also put somewhat of a floor into the market, so the market's not just dependent on foreign flows.
So interesting. And I feel like the next question to sort of bring in there is the fact that China and other Asian economies, but particularly China, has done so well to contain the virus. I mean, the world is still waiting for the when things can get back to normal. Just sort of outline for us where the recovery is. I mean, we've seen huge GDP numbers out of China considering what's been going on.
Remember last time we spoke about these three drivers or three prongs that we're looking at across all markets. So the first one being the flattening of the COVID curve. And when we look at how China's really contained the virus itself. Now, albeit the borders are still closed from an international perspective. But for example, in October, we had something like 57 days up until the 11th of October where we didn't have a localized case coming through. And even the cases in Hong Kong are now dropping. And so the outbreak, it was about 6 COVID cases on the 11th, as I mentioned, in Qingdao. And just to give you a sense of the action that's taken. So within 5 days, 11 million tests were undertaken to test the entire city. And if we put that into perspective over the same time period or maybe from the month, the beginning of the month to the 12th of October, across the United States, you're only seeing about 1 million, roughly, cases a day being taken. Not cases, but in terms of tests. So that level of testing is really, really pronounced in China. And also the Chinese biotech companies, the pharmaceutical companies, they're also in this race to come up with a vaccination. And the numbers aren't confirmed yet from a public perspective or government perspective, but we are hearing that about 60,000 people have already taken an antivirus vaccination. So again, you're just seeing this real sort of pace not just in terms of containment, but also the vaccination progress.
It's interesting on the vaccination progress, because it requires, obviously, across sort of a health system, an enormous amount of collaboration. A Chinese vaccine would be just sort of from China. Is there collaboration already within kind of the biotech health sciences, you know, across the region, perhaps, or even further afield? It seems to be broken up into which country gets it first, but there is collaboration, isn't there?
Well, it's really interesting. Again, you know, you read the headline news flow about, you know, AstraZeneca and these Chinese companies, Russia, etc. But the biotech management teams we are speaking to are saying, actually, there's a lot of global collaboration from a science perspective, which I think is really refreshing given the situation the world finds itself in. So, you know, I think that's really important in terms of that aspect. And then also the Chinese government, and we're probably going to hear more and more about this, but you're already hearing the government talk about they're looking to provide the funding or the vaccinations themselves for more of the EM or frontier economies. And it's part of sort of, some people are saying in a very negative way, it's their way of trying to gain control, part of Belt Road Initiative. But really, they are looking at it as their responsibility as well, especially when there's been so much, you know, attention being put on them in terms of this is where the virus potentially originated from.
Right. It's a very interesting side of things. You spoke last time, I think you've spoken a couple of times about this idea of dual circulation. It certainly involves a further engagement of the domestic economy with kind of different, maybe a different tilt towards trade, still important, but a slightly different tilt towards it. Can you put that and the whole domestic economy in context just ahead of this? I'll make sure I get this right, the 14th five-year plan, known as a plenum, which begins, I believe, next week. What might they discuss?
Exactly, as you highlighted, so this focus on the strength of the domestic economy. So again, when we look at, you know, going back to your first point that you raised about why people are looking at China in a sort of safe haven, you know, some mindset. And when we look at China itself, so much of the economy is now driven by the consumption story, the services story, you know, since March. So don't forget the peak was in February in terms of the Chinese peak. Since March, we've now had 7 sort of V-shape recoveries per month. So yes, we are definitely seeing this recovery. We're seeing this normalization, and it's all playing out from a domestic demand perspective. But the dual circulation is also now looking at making sure there aren't any significant disruptions to China's supply chain. And again, if we look at why there's this focus on China, we've been talking about it for years in terms of the importance of China in one's portfolio, and that we would see more and more indices have a bigger weighting to China. But if you just think about it, I mean, China's something like 40% now of global growth. So that's more than Japan, Europe, and the US combined. So if you have that impact, you can't decouple, you can't ignore China. And again, when the Chinese are so focused on the domestic demand story, this is why the market is looking so attractive for people, because it's, I'm not saying that China can survive without the rest of the world. It can't from a trade perspective, et cetera. But you can see why the things that are playing out in China are pretty robust in terms of the recovery story.
You know, it's interesting too, just to sort of bring into perspective some of the discussions around what sometimes is known as a bit of a techno-nationalism. A lot of countries are going through these thoughts of whether the development of various third-generation chips, of quantum computing, AI, how that gets incorporated, and how it's sort of a national security priority as well. Is there a divergence between the way China is looking at that and the rest of the world? It may also come into the supply chain discussion. Where is that conversation at this point?
I think, again, when we look at the whole trade environment, and the US elections are obviously going to be quite impactful in terms of what happens going forward. But having said that, no matter which side wins in the US, you're going to have this very competitive sort of situation continue between the United States and China. A lot of people are saying, well, where does this leave the rest of Asian economies, and will they have to pick a side? In fact, even in Europe, you often hear the Europeans say, well, I have to pick a side, go west, east, etc. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. What I think is fascinating, and it exists really, in fact, if you look at it from a private equity perspective and the entrepreneur segment, yes, China really dominates in this space, but there's so much collaboration that goes on from an intra-regional perspective. And again, if I think about this sort of sense of national pride, we're seeing it across, you know, a lot of Asian countries, economies, etc. But this week alone, we had two company meetings. One was with a fashion designer or brand, and how, you know, they're not copying the J. Crews of the world or the Ralph Laurens or the Chanels. They're creating their own identity. It's a bit like that sports apparel company that I mentioned a few months ago, in terms of, you know, not copying the international brand, but creating a Chinese identity. And then even things like, for example, there's this app called Bilibili. I don't think we've spoken about this, but it's all these brands, because there are so many brands, especially in the consumption space, have to realize the competition, the intensive competition. So they'll often either go geographically, or like that's their segment they look at, or they'll go, for example, demographically in terms of age groups. So Bilibili, it's really, it's like the YouTube of China, but for Generation Z. And in fact, our lovely trader in Shanghai, I said to her, do you use this a lot? She goes, yeah. I said, why? She goes, there's a lot of anime. It's very in tune to the mindset of the younger generation. She goes, you wouldn't like it though. You know, you stick to WeChat. I was like, are you saying because I'm old? She goes, well, you're just not my generation. But in order to become a member on this app, and it's so popular, so the monthly average user base is skyrocketing, you have to take a test, Pamela. You have to pass. There are 100 questions. It's usually about etiquette. You have to pass. I felt a bit better that one of my managers I work with, he also didn't pass. So again, just little things like this, they're targeting in a way the Chinese consumer base and really understanding the consumers that sometimes the international brands aren't. And I think that's why, again, they're forging ahead in these kind of categories.
And it gives that long-term view, which is it's such an opportunity for China in, you know, it's not exposed to these election cycles, basically. It doesn't have to have that short term. It can sort of begin and keep going with these trends. Very interesting. We'll have to create a community of people who don't pass the exam. Maybe that's a whole separate thing. I want to ask a little bit about the retail investor. In China, we've seen, obviously, incredible success in IPOs. We talked about this in the past. Retail investors often are discussed as going after the brands that they know, because perhaps they're not in a position to do deep research in other sectors or areas. Or how much is that the case, and how much does that allow perhaps other opportunities to be sort of sitting there like gold mines that are not being touched, for instance?
Well, you know, as the investor base grows in China, so too does the asset management and the investment banking segments. So you are seeing more and more research being undertaken. Having said that, the A-share market's a really deep market. There are so many companies. There are so many companies coming to market now. I mentioned the Star Bourse. So that's almost like the NASDAQ equivalent in China. It's up to nearly 200, or it might have passed now, 200 IPOs, either as, you know, they're doing their applications now, or they've listed. And that bourse has only been around for just over a year. So when we look at the retail investor base, they still, when we look at daily turnover, make up around 90% of daily turnover. But it's not just China, by the way. So we're seeing now in South Korea, Taiwan, this retail investor base really, really increase. And often they go towards certain themes or thematic. So, for example, in China, what's been stellar in terms of performance has been biotech, it's been big tech, consumer-related tech names. If we look sort of just at the daily movements, though, so even today you saw the market coming off a bit because of concerns about liquidity, given this huge, what we call a mega blockbuster IPO, it's Ant. So Ant, which is the financial services arm of Alibaba, they're doing a dual listing in Hong Kong as well as the Star Bourse. So when you see such a big thing like this, then retail investors, obviously, as well as institutional money and Chinese institutional money, might flock towards that particular segment or a name, etc. But in general, I think it's, you know, don't forget, as I've spoken about in the past, this whole sort of the story about the income growing and company management teams being really cognizant of treating minority shareholders favorably. You know, all this is it's really positive in the long term in terms of building out the investment community in China, because it just gives households another option in terms of asset allocation to put their cash and make that cash work for them.
Right. It is fascinating watching sort of the maturing class of investors and how that's working. Is there anything else to know about sort of the themes that Ant Financial is bringing to the fore? I mean, perhaps not the stock itself, but I mean, even the idea of the central bank digital currencies that are being tried out in various countries. China seems to be trying it out as well. Where is that moving, and where perhaps is Ant Financial or others in that area in China? Are they in a better position perhaps than fintech in other parts of the world?
Yeah, and I often think, you know, why is this the case? And I even think that every time I go into China over the years, you know, at first it was very much a cash-driven society and they didn't really use credit cards. And now when I go, they still don't use credit cards because they've leapfrogged cash, credit cards apart, they've leapfrogged into digital and digital payments. And Alibaba and Tencent were the first sort of movers in this space. They have that first mover advantage. And so, yes, the PBOC or the central bank are trialing that to release a digital currency. And this might support the banks, by the way, who have been real laggards in the market because they haven't been spending the capex in terms of the fintech space. Plus, you know, the banks are probably going to be hurt should we see rising NPLs because if we see the economy stumble, et cetera, et cetera. But having said this, companies like Ant, I mean, you know, the street's kind of saying that this could be your biggest financial services company when we look at the potential market cap of it. And you know, just as I said, everything in China, I mean, I remember, in fact, you know, walking past a traditional fan stall with the man making his fans and painting the fans. And right in the middle of his fans was a little QR code payment system. So you're buying traditional products, but in a really modern way. And I think it's just a psyche, and it's not just the Generation Z guys who are playing on or using Bilibili. It's our generation. It's the older generation. It's just convenient. And they were just very, very quick to move towards this digital space. And again, this is why when the lockdown occurred, it didn't seem that abnormal to be living online, whether it was doing your education, whether it was buying your goods, whether it was getting food delivered, etc.
You know, the world over, of course, is looking for income, for stocks, perhaps that have dividends. It's been in question because it's been a rough time for so many companies, and the dividend payments have sort of been highlighted. How can investors look at sort of a value play, perhaps a dividend producer in China? Is it a more stable situation, generally speaking?
Really contrarian. So in fact, you know, a lot of commentators are arguing that you can't be value anymore in China. I would really disagree because we can still find value across all sectors. And interestingly, you know, a fund like the Fidelity China Fund, where Jing, who's our portfolio manager, she's very, her style bias is value contrarian. She's so unique to the rest of the market, even across most of our fund managers as well. But now you're seeing, because those names that have done very, very well, that are very heavily owned by the community, both foreign as well as the domestic Chinese community, we're seeing so many more clients asking us for diversification options. And it's not like the names she owns aren't delivering earnings-wise. It's not like they're not paying a dividend. It's not like you know, they're these typical value names. In China, as I mentioned earlier, you can find value across all sectors. But it just so happens that because it's been such a narrow rally, the names in her portfolio or the portfolio have been hurt because they've been completely ignored.
On sort of the financial opening of China, there are some companies that have found their way and they're offering funds and so on. What if you just provide some perspective again, just sort of on how that opening, has it been accelerated to an extent because of the world that we're living in right now, or is it pretty much right on course?
Seems to be right on course. So at the beginning of the year, the regulators or the policymakers did come out with a sort of a time frame for when they would start opening up the capital markets. And we seem to be on time. They're in no rush. You know, again, don't forget those two other prongs outside the flattening of the COVID curve, the pace of the economic recovery. I mean, we are seeing it. We are seeing, as I mentioned, I'd be cautious about calling the whole recovery a V-shape because, don't forget, China still has an exporting side. So if we don't see the same kind of recovery in global demand that we've seen in China, then that's obviously a threat for the Chinese exporters. But in general, we are seeing this normalization. And then even from a policy implementation perspective, you know, again, the policymakers took this really wait and see approach. Let's see what the data is telling us. Let's not just throw so much stimulus into the system, because that's the last thing we want, because we're actually, we still have an overarching debt situation. So they've been really, really balanced, I would argue, and disciplined in their approach. And so therefore, there doesn't seem to be a rush with anything. Everything, and this is going to probably come through also next week in conversations about the next five-year plan, everything is planned.
Interesting. That's so interesting, because the next question I wanted to, sort of theme I wanted to broach was ESG. And it's something that, I mean, there are various environmental reasons why it might be a rush to get moving with this. But it also is tied to political mandates, and we're seeing that sort of the U.S. presidential election certainly has some of that discussion in it. There's no question, and Europe is putting stimulus money on the table if it's ESG friendly for various, you know, there's strings attached. And I wanted to ask if you thought that China would be further. It's talked about some carbon policy. Might you see more of that in the discussions next week? But actually, also maybe do they not need to rush?
That could be one area where they are trying to highlight in terms of we've got to fix this problem. So, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say China can be all about renewable energy, because it's impossible. It's actually physically impossible. They do need to use coal, but they're trying to make that coal the cleanest possible coal. But they are targeting environmental issues. And when we look at the broader ESG sort of space, you know, the Chinese government is still on track to alleviate poverty or bring everyone out of poverty. And there are different gauges in terms of how they classify this, but that's still a key mark. And so therefore, you know, you hear companies talk about it really all the time, about their social responsibility towards society. So they'll often talk about the charities and their kind of work to help China as a society. And then corporate governance, you know, I mentioned sort of this focus on, especially the set on enterprises, really rewarding minority shareholders and ensuring, you know, the balance sheets are looking really, really healthy, paying dividends, free cash flow is a real priority. And I still maintain that, you know, some of the biggest progress we have seen, it's coming from a very low base over the past 2 years, has been China in terms of ESG and sustainable investing. And it's not just, you just don't feel like it's just a throwaway comment or lip service that the companies are sort of doing. And I'm saying not every single company is doing this, but the companies we're engaging with, you know. And I also think, you know, ESG for us isn't about owning only A and B rated ESG names. It's, you know, we can own, you know, poorly rated companies, but our engagement with these companies will improve these companies from this scoring perspective. And you know, again, when I think about our engagement, management teams are so interested to hear our thoughts as a foreign asset manager in terms of how they can improve. And you know, again, it's only very recently that the Chinese companies themselves do have guidelines around disclosure. Before, there wasn't any transparency because they weren't told or asked to do it.
That's interesting, because in Europe, there's sort of the discussion that they've been there, and we've seen assets sort of grow into that ESG already, and then North America, there'll be discussions about, well, there's just a lot more for them to do now that they're finally getting to this stage, and therefore further to grow in terms of an asset or an investment. And China perhaps also, I mean, would that sort of fit the bill, that there's room to grow into it, for instance, for an investor?
Definitely. I mean, you know, again, there's a lot of question marks over the independent boards, and this is why, from our perspective, you know, Fidelity really believes it's so important to be on the ground and doing active management in terms of really understanding the companies and creating relationships with these companies. Because don't forget, the whole ESG focus isn't just about improving investment or improving returns. It's also about helping society.
Yeah, no, the S side of things is sort of fascinating new area. Is there anything else sort of on the trade front? I mean, we've spoken a bit about the competitiveness that you expect to continue to see between mainly the United States and China. But, you know, in terms of regional trade, in terms of that, what can be done with borders closed? I mean, I guess that's just sort of the beginning and the end of the conversation. Until that is an easier situation. Is there anything else that's sort of being created in terms of trading relationships that might be of interest?
I still see these bilateral conversations going on. I mean, you know what's actually quite interesting, Pamela? It sort of combines what we were just talking about, ESG as well as trade. But Terence, who's our shipping and logistics analyst, he realized when he was, you know, looking at the future forecasts and earnings and order book numbers, et cetera, with the shipping companies, he started realizing that, hang on a sec, who are the people that are basically the who help support the trade from a human being like perspective? And I don't know whether it hit your newswires or anything, but in Asia, because of the very closed borders we had, you had these seafarers, so the people working on the ships, being stuck on the ships. So some for up to 15 months, the sort of the base or the normal period is about 9 months, regulation is a max of 11 months. And these poor seafarers are stuck on the ships. And so Terence actually took it to our stewardship team or our sustainable investing team, and they undertook this big project and trying to create a voice for these seafarers. I'm not saying they can change the whole situation, but yes, it's got that human aspect because how can you do that to people? But as well as it could actually disrupt trade because if people can't, you know, get off the ship and fly and you know, you don't have seafarers, that could actually cause big disruption. Anyway, so it's this piece of work we did, and it's still ongoing in terms of who Fidelity is now talking to from a sort of a broader committee base internationally to try and resolve the situation.
That's fascinating. I did read a little bit about that a while ago, you know, in the last month. It's a fascinating area. Well, look forward to sort of more research on that when it comes through. You know, there's a question for a lot of investors right now, where do certain things fit? And the world does feel like it's changing, and the way portfolios are crafted is changing a little bit because they're trying to figure out where their assets should be and where they might get the best protection, but also growth. Where does China fit in a North American portfolio? I know it's a broad question. There's probably a couple of ways to go at it, but is it something that can be not, you know, do you have to have it in your portfolio, basically?
I think so. I think all global portfolios have to have an exposure. And, you know, we're even hearing a lot of conversations or, you know, being asked, engaged in these conversations about whether longer term you will see an allocation, not just to EM in Asia, but it will be EM ex China, Asia ex Japan ex China. Just to give you a sense, you know, as I mentioned earlier about China's position from an economic perspective globally. And, you know, I think that in this current environment, yes, the A share market has been one of the best performing asset classes along with gold year to date. And you could see a bit of a pullback. But when you look at what's supporting the underlying thesis of owning China, when you look at the three prongs, as I mentioned, I think that over the short and medium term, you're probably going to see China actually from an absolute and relative perspective be one of the best performers, especially in the equities market.
Catherine, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for joining us. I wish you a good weekend as well.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.